At the end of Matthew chapter 12, Jesus asked the question, "Who is my mother? Who are my brothers?" So it's a question surrounding family, question surrounding Jesus' family. And the teaching that he offers really is, in many ways, is a bit puzzling. And we'll get into some of that here this morning. But it's a question about family and who belongs to the family of Jesus. The context of Matthew 12, we looked at the beginning of the chapter last week on the Sabbath day, and Jesus and the disciples, they do some things that results in accusations made against them by the Pharisees for violating the Sabbath. And we talked about how the Sabbath had been misused and abused by the Pharisees, that they used it as a means to control and to oppress, whereas the Sabbath day was instituted by God as a means to create an opportunity for Israel to reflect on creation and upon the Exodus. And they had failed to use it as such, and Jesus tries to correct him, because Jesus is the one who's bringing a new creation, and he's bringing about a new Exodus, and that's very much related to his purpose and message. But here we find, at this point of his ministry, while he does have critics, he has opponents, no doubt. The Pharisees have turned against him, and they're going to continue to plot throughout the rest of his life. But he's gaining momentum at the same time. You have leadership turning against him, but you have, you know, the average, ordinary people, people who are even the ones who are out on the margins of society are the ones who are being drawn to him. And that always seemed to be the case with Jesus, as people are coming, sick people, poor people, are coming to find something in Jesus. They want something from him, whether it's healing, whether it's food. They're coming to see him. There's not been anyone among the people like this for a very long time. They are associating him. Some have associated with him like one of the prophets, and certainly the prophets in the history of Israel had done some of the things that Jesus had done. They had. There's a history of signs and miracles having been performed among God's people. But Jesus, of course, is different. And they're starting to get that. They perceive him to be the Messiah. They want to make him king. And there's a lot of misconceptions, of course, that are behind what they think Jesus is going to be doing, or what they think the Messiah is going to be doing. And because of that, Jesus he retreats. You find him retreating all of the time. He performs these miracles with people, and then he says things like, "Now don't you tell anybody that I did this." And when we come across that, it's always strange, because, well, Jesus, he's gone public. He's doing some important things that people need to know. And surely, if you've received a miracle, you need to go out and you need to tell everybody what has happened and who you have encountered. And Jesus is saying, "Now don't you tell anybody about this." So you find him strangely retreating. And I think his retreat, of course, is due to the fact that Jesus knows that they're not ready for him. They're not ready for who he truly is. They're not ready for what he has actually come to do. They want to make him king. And there's political and social and economic implications in their expectations. And Jesus didn't come to satisfy those things. He came here for reasons that were far more significant than anything the people were perceiving. Another thing that happens in Matthew 12 as we work our way to this question is that Matthew, you know, he's the one who's narrating all of this. And Matthew starts to explain Isaiah and the Messiah and the Gentiles. And that's critical for us to recognize. You got to you got to catch that to understand the full force behind Jesus' teaching regarding who his family actually is. If you look here in verse 14 of Matthew 12, it says that the Pharisees went out and held counsel against him how they might destroy him. But when Jesus knew it, he withdrew himself from thence. Great multitudes followed him, and he healed them all and charged them that they should not make him known. So here's a conspiracy of the Gentiles, Jesus gaining momentum, but he's retreating, partly out of concern for his own safety. But in verse 17, though, Isaiah says, what's happening here? He's telling us, he's giving you the bird's eye view. He says, readers, listen, here's what's actually going on. He says that this is happening because of what Isaiah, that it might be fulfilled in verse 17, which was spoken by Isaiah the prophet, saying, behold, my servant whom I've chosen, my beloved in whom my soul is well pleased, I will put my spirit upon him, and he shall show judgment to the Gentiles. He shall not strive nor cry, neither shall any man hear his voice in the streets. A bruised reed shall he not break, and smoking flax shall not be quenched, till he send forth judgment unto victory. And his name shall and in his name shall the Gentiles trust. So Matthew, you know, on the other side of all of this, says the reason why he's retreating is because he wasn't going to be king like they thought. And Isaiah, matter of fact, had said, the Messiah is not going to be king like the people thought. But the other important aspect of what is mentioned in Isaiah has to do with the Gentiles. If you're not careful, you'll miss it. He's not just coming for Israel, but the Messiah is coming for the Gentiles. The Messiah is coming for the world. And that's part of this prophecy that Isaiah used to explain this specific moment in time here in Matthew chapter 12. So as we move forward in verse 22, though, he begins to cast out demons, showing his power over the realm of evil. And accusations are made against him because of this. And some people think he's the son of David. Other people think that he is Beelzebul, the son of the wicked. He's in league with Satan, and that's why he's able to have power over the demons. And of course, Jesus says, you realize your accusation doesn't make any sense. And if I was in league with Satan, I would not be working against him and casting out demons. There was, you know, the accusation is just, it's empty and illogical. But Jesus continues to go on here and speak against the Pharisees, but also try to explain his purpose in coming. Then the Pharisees, there in verse 38, they want a sign. Show us a sign, as if they've not seen enough. They're just looking for something else that Jesus can do, that somehow or another maybe they can use to discredit him. Do you have anything you'd like to mention about the context and the perception that they have about him being the Messiah and the Gentiles? Anything that stands out to you that you wanted to mention or ask about?
There's a real contrast between the multitude and the Pharisees. The multitude recognized that he was a great man. Are you the son of David?
Mm-hmm.
And the Pharisees denied him.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. A contrast. And that's always the case. It's the people, you know, they see him for what he is. They see his love, they see authenticity. Whereas when they look to the Pharisees, you know, there's hypocrisy. So there's a stark contrast that's made there, that people could clearly perceive on their own. Anything else?
We're told that the Pharisees and the scribes were jealous of Jesus. They saw his popularity. They saw him taking the masses away from them, and they were jealous of him.
Yeah. Yeah, and just in such a short period of time, Jesus gains what the Pharisees never had, in spite of all of their efforts, the length of time that they had influence, they never had the kind of influence over the people that Jesus has. Jesus is able to win hearts and minds, whereas the Pharisees, all they can do is try to oppress and control. So here, as we look at in verse 46, where we get to this question. Jesus he's got the people there, the Pharisees are there, he's teaching them. In verse 46 it says, "While he yet talked to the people, behold, his mother and brethren stood without, desiring to speak with him. Then one said to him, Behold, thy mother and thy brethren stand without, desiring to speak with thee. But he answered and said to them, Who is my mother and who are my brothers? And he stretched forth his hand to his disciples and said, Behold, my mother and my brethren. For whosoever shall do the will of my Father which is in heaven, the same is my brother and sister and mother." Kind of a strange way to end the scene, given the wrangling with the Pharisees. But he does something that's quite significant. A very important aspect of his purpose is expressed here. What are your impressions of Jesus' family? Not a lot is said about his family, but here they show up on the scene. What are your impressions of his family?
That's a very clear point, I think, in this context.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the difference between a physical and a spiritual family. You know, the other writers, I believe it's Mark who accounts for this and gives us a little different impression of Jesus' family here, that they think he's crazy. They think he's crazy. And so, what do they want with Jesus? They're trying to take him home. I mean, look what's happened in Matthew 12. There are some pretty wild things that have gone on. And he is angered and enraged some important people. And it's as if they've gone to just take him away. You know, you're going to get yourself in trouble. You're going to get us in trouble. They've just come to take him home. And that's why they're out there. Which is one of the things that I think is interesting about the family is that you remember early on when back at the wedding reception in Cana, you know, it's his mother who's there saying, "Why don't you do something?" And so now here we're at a place where he's done a lot of things. And now it's almost as if we got to take him home. So there's a lot of I think there's a lot going on here with his family. I think what they're doing is understandable. If you're in their position, I mean, they don't. There are things that, as William pointed, I mean, there's things that Mary has been shown, but she doesn't understand what a lot of that means, and so, you know, they've come to get him. Go ahead, Walter.
In John 7, in verse 3, as Christians, because he's identifying us as his.
Yeah, family. Yeah. So, about that, what do you think the significance of Jesus' family being outside? Aubrey?
Mm-hmm. You know, or to be preeminent in some way. Mm-hmm. It didn't seem like very many people in his family really wanted him to lift them up and make them really good.
Yeah, like sometimes maybe they did, other times maybe be careful what you wish for. They don't want the attention. You know, the writers of the gospel, they're very clever, and you have to pay attention to the details. I think the significance of his family being outside, not where he was, but they're outside. Matthew's trying to show us Jesus' family is not biological. Now, if you're an Israelite, that's pretty important. Matter of fact, that means everything to you. That somehow biology meant everything, right? We are the sons and daughters of Abraham. And therefore, being part of that family entitles us to, well, everything God had promised. And what Jesus starts to do is he redefines it. He redefines family. And he says, no, who's my family? My family are the ones who do the will of my Father. Now, we could spend a lot of time talking about, well, what's the will of the Father? If you were to try to just kind of get the essence of, well, what is the will of the Father? The will of the Father was to accept and obey the Son. And that's the issue that's going on here with the people and with the Pharisees, is some of them are and others of them aren't. The will of the Father is to receive and embrace Jesus for who he is and what he's going to accomplish. It's more expansive than that, of course, but that I think that captures just the essence of it. If you're going to accept Jesus as God's Son, as the Messiah, certainly you're going to be willing to do whatever he tells you. Because if he's God's anointed, that means the only thing that is left for you or anyone else to do is to bow before him. He's your king. I mean, God makes Jesus king through the things that are going to happen at the cross. And so doing the will of the Father has everything to do with believing and obeying Jesus. Anything else about how Jesus is redefining family? Yeah, it's not a slight. Jesus is not slighting his mother. As has been said, he's getting to this core reason for why he's come into the world, what he's trying to establish. So, of course, there are blessings of being part of God's family, and the New Testament bears that out. There's a relationship that we're able to have with God through Jesus. There's an inheritance. You think about the concept of family and what that entails. There's protection that God offers to his family through faith in Jesus. Peter explains all of that in 1 Peter chapter 1 in the opening lines of that letter. But how does he redefine God's family? You see, God's family was family of Abraham, Israelites, but here there's an implication that, well, you don't have to be an Israelite to become part of God's family. And then there's this issue that some of the Israelites, well, they're not even doing the will of the Father. So what does that mean regarding their relationship to the family?
Well, the last verse says, whoever does the will of my Father is my family.
Yeah, that's quite an inclusive term. Now, Jesus would talk about that occasionally, and I don't know how much that was picked up on by the people who heard it. For example, in John chapter 10 and verse 16, Jesus is talking about how he's the good shepherd. He says, I have other sheep that are not of this fold. I must bring them also, and they will listen to my voice. So there will be one flock, one shepherd. Well, what is that about? That you have others who are not of this fold? I mean, I think that, you know, the disciples were smart enough to understand the concept of God's family and being related to a sheepfold here. Chapter 1 of Acts, Jesus is about to ascend to heaven, and Jesus tells the disciples, you'll receive power when the Holy Spirit has come upon you, and You'll be my witness in Jerusalem and all Judea and Samaria to the end of the earth. Well, what do we need to go to the end of the earth for? Well, because that's wherever you're going to have to go to those who are not of the fold. Romans chapter 1 and verse 16, that, well, the gospel's for everybody. Paul starts to explain the consequence of what God accomplished through Jesus. In chapter 10 and verse 4, this is a huge, huge statement that is made. After Paul has tried to explain how God is bringing together Jew and Gentile through Jesus, he says, "For Christ is the end of the law for righteousness to everyone who believes." And the issue is, well, what is righteousness? What does it mean to be righteous? There's a larger explanation that's needed to really explain Paul's use of that term in the letter. The point is, if we want to become righteous and justified, brought into God's family, it's through faith. The law of righteousness is faith. Faith in who? Faith in what? Faith in what God accomplished through Jesus. And so, well, the Jews, that was unacceptable to a lot of them, because they thought, well, no, it was just for us. The Messiah is just for us. And he wasn't. The other way that... So Jesus expands the family in that it's to whoever believes, whoever does the will of the Father. But he also makes it smaller in some respects. It expands and contracts because you have people within Israel who don't believe. Well, am I part of God's family? No, you're not part of God's family. You're entitled to nothing. And that was hard to hear and to accept. Paul explains how they don't believe. Well, they still could. If they change their heart, they could become part of God's family. Now, he warns now to the Gentiles, now don't think that you're something special, that you're top dog now. Paul was concerned about pride there with them, that, well, the Gentile, God chose the Gentiles. Well, he wants everybody to become part of the family. And it happens to everyone who believes. And that's what Jesus is the whole point of the signs that he performs and the teaching that he gives. He wants people to become convinced, persuaded, that he's the Son of God and that life is received through obedience to him and to his word. William?
He changed the conditions. Mm-hmm. Before, to be an Israelite, all you had to do is be born.
Had to be born, yeah.
There was no... Now... But Jesus, there's a condition. Yeah. You have to do something.
Well, you have
it's
to be.
It's not apparent.
Yeah. You have to be born again.
There's a responsibility now on you to come and be a part of it.
There's a new birth. There's a new birth through the water and the Spirit that brings us in to God's family. So a couple takeaways here as we wind this down. Certainly we have to obey the will of the Father to become part of Jesus' family. That's evident in what he says here. A point that we didn't deal very much with, faith is the basis for fellowship. Have you ever asked, who's my brother? Now that's an issue of fellowship. Where's God's family? Who's part of God's family? How do you... That's important to determine and to define. Well, faith is the basis for fellowship. And the gospel's for everyone. And that point is significant to us, I think, as Ray pointed out, because, you know, we're not of Jewish descent, so that's good for us, because we were, you know, we would have been on the outside. But it also, if the gospel's for everyone, it should change the way we view everyone else in the world. Here's everyone else. The gospel's for everyone. And I should be trying to shine the light of the gospel to everyone without reservation, without partiality, without bias and prejudice. That's how that changes my view of the world. So a couple takeaways there. Well, thank you for your participation this morning. There's probably more that could be said out of this text. But an important question for us to consider whether or not we are part of God's family. And if we're not, what we need to be doing to change that, is the only hope that we have is by coming into fellowship with this family through our obedience to the gospel. So thank you.